I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My guest Saturday, Mel Schwartz, is a licensed social worker with a master's in philosophy. He is a psychotherapist and marriage counselor in private practice in Westport, Connecticut and Manhattan for over 20 years. He is an emerging voice in the field of personal transformation and is one of the first practicing psychotherapists to integrate the principles of quantum physics into a psychotherapy approach. He earned his graduate degrees from Columbia University and has been a keynote speaker at Yale University. Mel is also the author of The Art of Intimacy, The Pleasure of Passion, and he blogs for Psychology Today. His TEDx talk, Overcoming Anxiety, illuminates his approach to transcending this affliction. He has written over 100 articles read by more than 2 million people. Mel works with individuals and organizations globally, and he has also written numerous books, including the latest, The Possibility Principle, How Quantum Physics Can Improve the Way You Think, Live, and Love. He is also listed on Wikipedia. More information is available at www.melschwartz.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Mel, and I look forward to hearing about anxiety, depression, and change. First, you say anxiety and depression are epidemic rates. Can you tell us why this is true?
That's correct. Anxiety and depression, most of these pathologies are at epidemic rates. In the course of an American's lifetime, there's a 1 out of 2 chance that we'll be diagnosed with either anxiety or depression. So I call that an epidemic, a staggering rate. And the point I make here is if we, 50% of our people were mysteriously felt ill for an unknown reason, the Center for Disease Control would be working overtime. Well, we owe ourselves better than simply medicating anxiety and depression and making the pharmaceutical companies even wealthier. We need to ask why. Why are we suffering these epidemic rates? I believe it's due to the fact that we're living life from the wrong game plan. Now, here's what I mean. In the 17th century, the great scientists and thinkers, Newton and Descartes, created a model for how we understand reality. Descartes said reality pictures like picture a giant clock mechanism. Newton said that reality is like a giant machine known as the machine-like universe. And in that machine-like universe, it's comprised of separate parts. We became the parts in that machine, separated from each other, separate and discrete, disconnected, and having no meaning and purpose. Those worldviews, Carl, are steeped in the illusion or myth of separation. They tell us everything's separate from everything else. Well, if everything is separate from everything else, and that includes us, depression, ultimately, is the experience of feeling disconnected, meaningless, and purposelessness. So living under Newton's worldview, depression would have been predictable. Let's step over to anxiety for the moment. Newton gave us the law of determinism. He suggested that if we have enough information, today we call that data, we could reasonably predict the future. Now, this helped us industrialize and modernize the world and had great benefits. But taken to the extreme, I've seen that when people become addicted to or wed to certainty, where their thoughts actually need to know the future in advance, this induces fear and anxiety. You see, you can't know the future, but if you insist on knowing it, you create anxiety. I just gave a TEDx talk on this theme of how to overcome anxiety by embracing uncertainty. Furthermore, if we seek certainty in an uncertain world, we're not actually in the flow of life. We're not engaging life. We're sitting back as though we're playing in a chess match where we're analyzing and calculating the next move and thinking, would this be a mistake or not? That is static. It's inert. It's not flowing and moving with life. So I see this epidemic as primarily due to those causes, notwithstanding the profit motive of the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The solution lies in the messages coming to us for the last 100 years from quantum physics. See, quantum physics has revealed that reality is not the way we pictured it. It is uncertain. And here I pivot with that in my new book, The Possibility Principle. I propose uncertainty is good news because uncertainty equals possibility. So when we can counterintuitively embrace uncertainty, we can thrive. You think about it, people who are addicted to games. We go to sporting events and watch sports on TV. It's because of the uncertainty. We love not knowing, going to a thriller, reading a book, or watching a movie. The uncertainty of not knowing. We seek that in our lives, but on a personal level, we become choked by certainty.
Mm-hmm.
So when we learn to embrace uncertainty, I've helped so many people overcome anxiety and fear. As for depression, well, the quantum model of reality, just like Eastern mystical traditions, tells us that reality is actually one inseparable, interconnected, undivided whole. From that framework, we are all as one. Compassion and empathy and a sense of connection come back into our lives, and depression retreats. That's the big picture,
mm-hmm.
Carl. On a more macro level, I teach the people I work with and my readers to understand how to see their thought that seeks certainty, their thought that believes in separateness, and how to not become that thought, which is actually what I call thinking. You see, if I can see my thought and not become the thought, that's where change happens. That's what I call thinking. And that's my model of how we can come to create. I was going to say restore, but really create emotional and psychological and spiritual well-being. It all comes from changing our worldview into what science is telling us over the last 100 years.
So is this your drug-free solution to anxiety and depression?
Absolutely. I am not an extremist. I am not proposing that in all cases one must stay away from drugs. I have seen medication assist people at certain levels. That said, if the medication is accompanied by effective talk therapy, it may be helpful. It's the indiscriminate writing of prescriptions to medicate people and to suppress their symptoms because the powers that be don't understand that we can actually overcome these conditions. We don't need to manage them. We can overcome them. And so, I am opposed to the indiscriminate use of medication in lieu of strategies to help us transcend our problems.
Mm-hmm. Then, Mel, you say that seeking certainty leads to anxiety. Can you give us an example?
Certainly. I'll use an illustration, which is in my TED Talk and in my book. I was working with a woman who came to see me around her anxiety. She shared that she was unhappily married in midlife. She and her husband had tried marital counseling. It didn't work. They had grown apart. They didn't enjoy one another's company. Yet, they were both financially independent and had no children. So I asked her, why was she staying married? And she said, I'm afraid I don't know who I would be if I were divorced. You see, there it was, the fear of the unknown,
mm-hmm.
the fear of uncertainty was keeping her trapped in the certain. Even though the certainty of her life was dismal, she preferred the known to the promise of the unknown. So I created a visualization exercise for her. I asked her to close her eyes and imagine that she was by the bank of a river. I asked her to look at the river and see the current flowing and picture that current metaphorically as the flow of life. So I had her imagine stepping into the river and getting into the current. After a few moments passed, I asked her what she was seeing. She said, "Well, Mel, I got into the flow of the river, but there was a big boulder in the middle and I grabbed a hold of it."
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her why had she done that. She said, "Well, the river bends to the right up ahead and I can't see where it's going. And I need to know where it's going." And I said to her, "You're not supposed to know where it's going. That's the future. You can navigate as we get in the flow. You're free to direct where you're heading, but you must get in the flow." So that bend up ahead for her might have been, who would I be if I were divorced? She couldn't know that as she was married, but she would have to navigate and move into the flow. And a visualization like that helped her. More fundamentally, I teach people to see the repetition of old habitual thoughts. So in this case, the old habitual thoughts of people would be, "I need to know, I don't know." And then they feel anxious and they feel fearful. We can learn to detach from those old recurring thoughts and actually picture embracing uncertainty rather than resisting it. And that's the method.
And what do you mean when you say uncertainty is the essence of romance?
Well, I have to give credit for that quote to the great novelist Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde said uncertainty is the essence of romance. So what did he mean? And what do I mean? Well, if you think about romance, the early stages of meeting and falling in love, it's awash with uncertainty. You don't know how the other person feels about you. Maybe you're feeling attraction or incipient love for them. You're not sure how they're feeling about you. We don't really know each other yet. There's so much wonder, so much curiosity. It helps us really be present and engage each other. It's scintillating. But what happens once the relationship is secured? We rush off toward predictability. So if uncertainty is the essence of romance, then predictability is the death knell of romance and passion. We need to invite some uncertainty back into established committed relationships. And I don't mean risk-taking by uncertainty. I mean playfulness, communication, and experiences not being formatted and predictable, not having sex by prescription on a Saturday night after dinner in the same location in the same way. We need to mix it up a bit. That's what I mean.
I work with a lot of cancer patients, and a lot of people advocate detoxing, but it's always detoxing of the body. Well, there are a few doctors that detox the mind, and so can you tell us what you mean by detoxing of the mind?
So over the course of our lifetime, we have millions of thoughts. The majority of those thoughts are old and familiar. And many of those thoughts limit and debase and constrain who we are. These may be thoughts that sound like, "I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not attractive enough, why am I always unlucky?" All of the thoughts which come out of beliefs that we have about ourselves, which limit us. Where did those beliefs come from? Typically, they may have come from some childhood experiences or interactions or words we've had. They all set up a toxicity, the recurring, limiting, or even punitive thoughts that we have impact our whole being. The moment you have a thought, the thought summons up the accompanying emotion. Thought and feeling work in tandem. So if you have a fearful, anxious, or self-critical thought, you're going to have the accompanying feeling that sets up a toxicity. So I have written and taught workshops around detoxing your mind And the strategy is similar to what I've already described. You know, to go into it in depth, you'd have to, you know, move into reading the book or work in a more focused way. But putting it simply, detoxing your mind is to encourage thinking, which allows you to see your negative beliefs and your negative thoughts and stop and pause and say, I'm not attaching to that. You see, in the nanosecond before you have your next thought, we exist in a state of pure potential. But if we keep having the same old thought, we never access those new possibilities. And that's why we say it's hard to change.
Mm-hmm. This is a lot like Louise Hay's work. Are you familiar with her?
I am somewhat, yes.
And except she talks more about using affirmations to overcome some of the negative that has taken place in your life. I found her work very helpful when I was younger because I had inherited in my mind a lot of the negativity from childhood.
And yes.
So it's basically...
affirmations can be helpful for many people.
Mm-hmm.
For some people benefit from going deeper. Mm-hmm. And not just replacing the negative thought with an affirming thought, but actually learning how the whole thinking process operates. I use a term, a mastery of thinking, which is when I can help people develop a mastery of their thinking, they have a more powerful, sovereign sense of themselves. So they are no longer just their beliefs and thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And Mel, you write that most of our struggles come from living with the wrong game plan. What is the right game plan?
The correct game plan is which I model from these principles of quantum theory. So the right game plan is that reality is flowing, unperturbed, always in flow. That's how reality presents itself, and we are part of that reality. The further principle is that everything is interconnected with everything else, which means that I and you and listeners, we are all a participatory part of an unfolding wholeness, so that what is good for the other is good for you. Compassion and empathy, cooperation and collaboration replace competition and extreme individuality. The new game plan is that uncertainty is a good thing. It equals possibility. So the rules that we have been taught going back 350 years is the wrong game plan.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't serve us. Let's get familiar with the new principles, which allow us to usher in a quality of our emergence and living resilient lives without fear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And why is it so hard for people to change?
Well, firstly, there's a belief that it's hard to change. So that belief in itself becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, of course, going back to that model of Newton's worldview, the giant machine, Newton taught us that there's only movement when there's cause and effect. Something has to impact something else. On a more personal level, as I just referred to, if I keep having the same old limiting beliefs and thoughts, of course it's hard to change. And so it doesn't have to be hard to change. If I need certainty and I need to know what the future is going to bring and I can't know it, change is going to be pretty darn difficult, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
So embracing uncertainty allows us to release fear, get into the flow of life, and then change is inevitable.
It's very difficult from the point of view of a health professional to bring about that change. I know when I was doing public health nursing, I would go out and the families would be watching television and I'd ask them to turn the television off and I would talk with them about the best way to stay healthy through their prenatal period. And then I would help them with bathing and doing all the things for the newborn, but they continued to just, you know, do what they wanted to do, and it seemed like it was very difficult for those people to make any type of change. And
yeah, I think the way we approach that, Carl, is probably we can't just tell people what they should do,
mm-hmm.
because our nature is resistant. So, you know, the way I would go after something like that is to actually ask questions, to draw people out, like, what do you struggle with? What would you like to see change in your life? Why do you think it isn't changing? In other words, we have to enroll people
mm-hmm.
and enlist them so that they are the engine behind the change process. Otherwise, if we're just telling them what they need to do, you know, that mm-hmm. doesn't work too well.
Well, I've learned that with friends, at least, I have developed the attitude that people have to have experiences, and sometimes that's the way they learn. And so I do not, for example, a friend recently overcome radiation and chemo for cancer. And
right.
he's eating a lot of sugar. He craves sugar. So I told him one way that he could take away the craving. But he responds that the nutritionist told him that he could have 36 grams of carbohydrate a day. And that is, he said, two Cokes. And so I figured, well, he'll learn that he can't have that. And the learning may be difficult, but he's got to learn on his own. It's his lessons. You know, you can tell people and you can question them, but if they don't want to take action, then, you know, you have to leave it alone. Solve it themselves.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, when people eat things that are dangerous, not healthy, or carcinogenic,
mm-hmm.
and there's the expression we hear, well, a little won't hurt you.
Right.
I'm fond of saying, how do you know that? How did you come to that belief that a little won't hurt you, or everything in moderation? In other words, we have to look at these beliefs
mm-hmm.
and ask, how do you know? By the way, as an aside, 36 grams of carbs, so instead of two Cokes, they might have had two apples and a pear and gotten some healthy carbs instead of
right,
the Cokes.
Right, right. But he was talking about simple carbohydrate, not complex.
Yes.
And the
reality is we'd be better off without any simple carbohydrate.
Right, right. And it's difficult because a nutritionist told him that. And I'm just a nurse. I'm not a nutritionist. But from talking with him, I know a lot more about nutrition for cancer patients than his nutritionist does.
Without a doubt, in a circumstance like that, Carl, a way you might handle that going forward is to say, well, I think everyone would agree that simple carbs are bad for us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'm perplexed as to why anyone would say, just limit how much of the bad stuff you take. Wouldn't it be better to take no bad stuff? Would somebody say to you, it's okay to smoke three cigarettes a day? No, you shouldn't smoke any. So I appreciate your frustration there, but sometimes we need to step out and come after it a different way.
Well, it's also the same, and many people experience this that work with the alternative treatments, and that is many people choose, and my brother chose radiation because he had had a doctor for 40 years, and his doctor recommended it. But most oncologists are not going to recommend alternative. They're going to recommend radiation, chemo, and
right.
surgery. And again, you've got the same thing where this is harmful to the body. And I know this, but how do I get this across to someone else? Because also they're getting pressure from family, from friends, from all kinds of people. So it takes a really strong person like me to go against what is still pretty much standard practice.
Yeah, and standard practice, regrettably,
mm-hmm.
often equals mediocre practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have to look at these terms. Standard, the word standard doesn't evoke high quality. Standard kind of evokes ordinary. So it's in the words. I might say to someone, well, that is standard practice, but let's look at the term standard. Wouldn't you like exceptional instead of standard? Why would we default to standard practice? That's how I try to help people look at things differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us about letting go of old beliefs and thoughts, which keep us mm-hmm. from reaching our potential? If someone,
sure,
they have to want to do that, though, before they're going to do it.
Well, of course. So the first question is, consider the beliefs you have about yourself you think limit you. And then ask yourself, how did I come to that belief? How do I know that belief is true? Ordinarily, your memory may go back to a childhood experience, something a parent or a teacher or a friend said to you, and it wounded you, and you stayed with it. I'll give you an example. I was working with a woman who, she was middle-aged when I worked with her, but she recounts that when she was 9, her mother told her that her pregnancy with her was an accident. It wasn't planned.
Mm-hmm.
She was unwanted. So this poor girl, and decades later, this woman lived with this core belief about herself that she wasn't lovable, that she wasn't important. After all, she was an accident. So I helped her see this core belief that she had, and that if her mom had never said that to her
mm-hmm.
or had planned her pregnancy, then her belief about herself would have been different. Beliefs are fungible. They're transitional. They're just beliefs. And so, therefore, the thing to do is ask yourself, what are my beliefs about myself to hold me back? How did I come to these beliefs? Why do I think they're true? And then set the intention to release yourself from the imprisonment of those old beliefs and old thoughts and allow yourself to begin to envision some beliefs and thoughts that serve you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about couples, how you stop them from arguing
mm-hmm.
and listening to one another. And I think of a couple I was in. It was somewhere in Europe. An American couple were in the middle of the square arguing with each other because he was supposed to meet her at a certain time or a certain, yeah, I guess it was the time. And she was there waiting, and he didn't get there, and they were arguing. And I just innocently walked up to them, and I said, you know, it's a beautiful day. We're in a beautiful city in a foreign country. We don't have this opportunity very often, and yet you found the time, instead of enjoying this, you're arguing. I said, I don't mm-hmm. understand this. And that... I guess they were maybe shocked or something. And so they, you know, they stopped their arguing and they said, well, thank you for reminding us of this. But it's interesting because, you know, you often see people arguing and yet they love each other. So they say. So
yeah.
Tell me about that.
Because we get into this mindless back and forth like a ping pong ball. A technique I've developed a way through this. When you're in an argument or antagonistic discussion, our tendency is to find something that the other person's saying and to refute it, to prove them wrong
mm-hmm.
so I can be right. And as we all know, that never works. Because if I need to be right, it means you need to be wrong. You're not going to be very open to that. So the technique I've developed I call it the 5% rule, which is when you're hearing the other person talk, instead of looking for the majority of what they're saying that you think they're wrong about, find a small percentage. Let's call it 5%. Find a small percentage of what they're saying that you can agree with. And take the 95% you don't agree with and just suspend it for the moment. I want you to validate the 5% you can't agree with. Say to them, you know what? When I heard you say that, I did hear something there that you accused me of, which I agree with. I do see that. I do that to other people. I do that to you. You know, I can appreciate how that feels. Now, when you've done that, you've turned the energy of the communication. They are now in a position that they feel heard, understood, and validated. They're now in the position to take in what you have to say. So you see, employing the technique of finding something to validate shifts us from an argument into a reasonable conversation.
Good. And you mentioned earlier the nanosecond. So in the nanosecond before our next thought, we exist in a state of pure potential. Can you describe what happens in that moment?
This is derived from quantum physics, that in the moment before you make an observation, reality is actually suspended. It's waiting to happen. It's the observation of something that makes it real. So it goes from a state of could be into a state of actually is. So I thought metaphorically, same thing happens in our lives, and it's around our thought. In the space between my two thoughts, I'm in the suspended state of pure potential. But over the course of my lifetime, if I keep having the same old thoughts, I never access that potential. So what I need to do is to see the old thought and choose not to become it and allow something new to come in, new thinking, new insight. Then I can access new possibility in my life.
And what is your technique called wave collapse? And how does it help your clients to break free from their past and become the author of their new script?
Go back to quantum physics. Light. Light has a dual capacity. Light can exist either in a wave form or as a particle. Now, when light exists as a wave, that wave in quantum physics equals your potential. But the moment that light wave is observed, the wave literally collapses and becomes a particle, a fixed, finite thing. So it moves from potential to fixed. I thought, metaphorically speaking, something similar happens to us in our lives. We come into life more or less in a state of pure potential. We're not yet shaped. Our identity and personality is not yet formed. We're amorphous, full of potential. Certain things happen, often in childhood, and our wave of potential collapses, and we begin to think of ourselves in a very fixed way, like that woman at 9 years old who had her mother say, "My pregnancy with you was an accident." That's a wave collapse. Now, the wave collapse sets in motion your core beliefs and thoughts about yourself. And some wave collapses can be positive. Some are limiting. I call those confining wave collapses. So what we want to do is notice those old wave collapses, the confining ones. Again, ask ourselves, how did I come to these beliefs about myself? And then in a moment, you can turn, pivot, and create a defining moment where you say, what if it's not true? And you free yourself from the imprint of the old wave collapse. And you head off in a new direction. That's when you're writing a new script for yourself.
And why do we struggle in relationships?
We're uneducated. We got no schooling on how to succeed in arguably what's the most important thing for us to succeed in. So model for education often is your parents. Regrettably, with some exceptions, they didn't provide a great model. You went to school and you learned history and English and math and science. Who taught you about emotional intelligence, communication, feelings, the effective way to communicate those feelings? No one taught us. So we struggle because we're ignorant, because our culture and society hasn't valued teaching us the most important things. You can learn at any time.
But maybe you can look at that from a different point of view, and that is that people come into our lives because there are lessons that we need to learn, and these people that come into our lives help us to learn those lessons. And when we've learned the lessons, they may leave our lives, which is a...
Well, I mean, that is, of course, true. And it is a somewhat spiritual perspective.
Mm-hmm.
In my work with couples, in every instance, one person's challenges provoke the other person's growth.
Mm-hmm.
And one person's growth incites the other person's challenges. So mm-hmm. there's always opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, in Chinese, the word crisis means opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So the opportunity is always there, and relationship is a vehicle for our learning. But when we get wrapped up in right and wrong and win and lose, those methodologies, that template is destructive to learning what we need to learn and to thriving in our relationships.
And you say that in falling out of love, that it is inevitable that you will fall out of love with someone. Is that correct?
Well, no, that's not quite what I said. I said falling out of love is altogether commonplace. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's inevitable. There are people, they are the exception, who never fall out of love. But
right.
falling out of love is commonplace because we don't prioritize the relationship. Again, if uncertainty is the essence of romance and helps us fall in love, well, if our relationship becomes predictable, mundane, and we deprioritize the relationship, we don't treat one another with the same value, then falling out of love is predictable. But we have to engage the relationship from a different framework and a different intention and say, ask ourselves, what do I need to do to not fall out of love? At times I work with people and do premarital counseling, and their relationship is great, and they're not yet married.
Mm-hmm.
They're wise enough to come in and say, help us learn how not to fall out of love. And that requires an emphasis on a whole new level of communication and commitment to the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And commitment there doesn't mean the commitment of saying, I'll always love you and I'll never cheat on you. The commitment has to be to the process, not mm-hmm. to the outcome.
Well, do you think that the culture sometimes supports being in love? The reason I'm asking that is because most of my brothers and sisters maintained a loving relationship with their partners throughout life. My brother mm-hmm. died. He was 91. He and his wife had been married for 70 years. I never heard them argue. I never heard them have any major disagreement. I've talked with their children. They didn't either. My older sister, she's 90. It was the same, you know. And yet, I think back, we came up during the Depression when things were not easy. There was the war that pulled people together. It was, to me, the golden age in this country. People cared about people. Our politicians cared about people. Our health care was a paid fee for service, and if you couldn't afford it, the doctor just kind of wrote it off. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a whole different culture than we live in today. And I, I wonder how much the culture played in keeping people together, because they grew up in that culture, so their values probably were different.
Well, culture has a powerful influence on who we are and our relationships. In terms of your family, well, one generation impacts the next. And so if your sibling had a great, wonderful relationship and marriage, it's not surprising if that then benefited their offspring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's regrettable, but anecdotes like that and stories like that are the exception. My parents had a wonderful love affair and were best friends for 55 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was blessed by experiencing that,
mm-hmm.
which led me to much of the work I do. Most people, sadly and regrettably, don't experience that because of fear, because they were raised in a way that wasn't healthy or harmful, because of drugs, because of alcohol, because of poverty. There are a lot of things that can get in the way of our thriving. But at the core, we are social animals, but we don't get an education on how to be effective in our social relationships. And it may be more true now than it was when you were a young man, Carl.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think it was because we didn't have the drugs. You know, we didn't
right.
have a lot of the social issues that we have today.
That's true.
We didn't even have the genetically modified food. We grew our own fruit and vegetables. It was all, you know, it was healthy. Everything was...
And we talked to one another instead of looking at our cell phones.
Right. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have television. We did have a radio,
right.
but we rarely ever turned it on. People just mm-hmm. dropped in because we didn't have telephones. And my family got together with a group of people that they were close with, and they would just drop in, or they would arrange to get together. They would then play cards. They'd have booby prizes. They'd have prizes for the person that won the most card game. And they mm-hmm. always included the children. They
yep.
square danced. We had someone that called for square dancing, and so we'd have square dancing. And the children were also included in the square dancing. So it was people that cared about other people, and they did things together. And, you know, I think that it was a whole different situation than it is today.
Well, it was. That said, it's important for us not to surrender
mm-hmm.
to the culture and get out there and do the very best we can.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Then you say there is no mind-body connection, even though I hear a lot about this, because mm-hmm. there's no mind-body separation.
Right. So what I'm getting at there is, since there is no separation, the word connection is a faulty word, because connection implies you found a bridge or a tunnel to connect two separate things. Well, if you think about it, mind and body, why would we ever think they're separate? Well, it's Descartes, the great philosopher, who said, "I think, therefore I am." And in that one sentence, he severed mind and body. Now, we see ample evidence that mind and body are as one. Placebo effect. Taking a placebo that you think is medication is as likely to benefit you as the actual medication, which means thought has the ability to heal the body. So thought and body are not separate, and we shouldn't simply write it off as a placebo effect. We should look at that and, wow, what can we derive from that? So what is in your physical being is in your thoughts and your mind. And what's in your mind is in your physical being. We have to get past thinking of mind-body connection. That would be like looking at a wave in the ocean and saying, you know, there are separate molecules of water in that wave, but they're part of one wave. The way we think is we separate things out. I call it fragmentation. And we think, because we see things as separate, they're really separate. They're not.
Well, I think, again, this came about because mind-body connection is primarily something in the healthcare area. And I think that, you know, back when I was growing up, again, the doctor handled everything. But as we, in quotes, progressed, there was a psychiatrist, there's a gastrologist, there's endocrinologist, there's the cardiologist, mm-hmm. there's all of these people that are dividing up the body, and the mind is separate too. So everything became separate parts. So you sacrifice the connection because you're trying to specialize and have more in-depth medical care. And I think that's how it became important to reintroduce the concept of mind-body connection. And with me, I started in 1970 putting things together, although I think nurses tended to keep things more together, although mm-hmm. there are yeah. cardiologists, cardiology, nursing, there's all these different areas of nursing. But I started putting things together because of my interest in Edgar Cayce, who, and mm-hmm. I don't know if you know the name, but...
Oh, yes, I certainly do.
Edgar Cayce was a big believer in a holistic approach. And mm-hmm. I went to camp. I was friends with the Cayces. I went to camp and volunteered as a nurse for 4 years. And in the early 70s, and then when I had lung cancer, it was very natural to use a holistic approach. And it's becoming popular again, but there were many years where people didn't think about holism or didn't think about mind-body. They thought about little pieces.
That's right. All very true. And, you know, we can analyze and drill down to the smallest parts, mm-hmm. but when we reassemble the parts, they don't reconstitute the whole. The whole is what we need to pay attention to. And understand the whole's comprised of parts, but it's something much more connected and much more unimaginable and wonderful mm-hmm. than simply the separate parts.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mel, is there anything you'd like to say before we look at your book and any services or product and how the listeners can reach you?
Well, best way to reach me is my website, which is my name, Mel Schwartz, that's MelSchwartz.com. My new book is called The Possibility Principle, How Quantum Physics Can Improve the Way You Think, Live, and Love. It's sold on Amazon and everywhere. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can purchase it on my website as well. Just given a new TEDx talk on overcoming anxiety in 9 minutes and the approaches we've talked about. You can find all of that on my website as well. So that's the best place to go. I have over 100 articles there, many of them touching on the topics that we've talked about today, Carl.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any products or available for consultation or
services? Yes, I am. Okay. I'm located in New York City and Westport, Connecticut, mm-hmm. but I work with individuals, couples, and corporations throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
Given the new technology of Zoom and Skype and FaceTime, I do virtual sessions mm-hmm. with people everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good. And would you give us the website then that people can
sure.
reach you?
Sure. The website is, again, it's my name, MelSchwartz.com, MelSchwartz.com. And at that website, you should be able to find everything you might be looking for.
Great. Well, I appreciate this very much, Mel. It's an interesting way to look at reality and anxiety and depression and relationships, and it's will, I'm sure, be helpful to people that are in relationships and having struggles and all of that. So I live alone.
It's been my pleasure, Carl. It's been a delight talking with you. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey, on my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.